Welcome to Divergent Paths with Dan Dunford. I am Dan Dunford, and I hope you enjoyed your Memorial Day. Memorial Day is a holiday, and the reason that this is coming out a day later than usual, because holidays, it's important to observe them. And Memorial Day, of course, is as a product of a very strong military family, is a special and a little bit more intense one for me than it might be for the general public. But anyway, that's not what I'm here to talk about. This week, I had a really special or cool one to listen to for everyone. That was awkward, but guess what? It's real, so I'm leaving it in. I guess, does that make it more valid? I don't know. Anyway, I was due, thanks to my friend Ray Riccomini of the Metropolitan Opera Orchestra, I was able to sit down with Mary Hammond, who is one of the wonderful violists also in the Metropolitan Opera Orchestra. And I have to say, Ray, having done the podcast, knew exactly the kind of person to put me in touch with, and had just a really wonderful chat conversation with Mary. Went up to her beautiful apartment in East Harlem and marveled at the wonderful views of Manhattan and talked about music for an hour, and it was awesome. And I really enjoyed it, and I think you will as well. Cool thing about, I don't know, sometimes when you talk to people who play in orchestras, no matter the level of that orchestra, they have a tendency to obscure some of the things that may not be the greatest about some of the difficulties of playing an orchestra, because, I mean, let's be real, it's hard to make a living as a musician, and when you have a job like a good job like that, you want to be grateful, but there's things that come along with that that are a little bit more challenging. And Mary really gave really great even-handed, highlighting the absolutely wonderful things about playing in an orchestra, but also being honest about some of the challenges that come along with that. Whether that's exhaustion from playing so long, or just the challenges of playing on stage after being in a pit for years at a time. An orchestra pit, not just a pit in the ground, in case you were wondering. I'm sure you were. Anyway, like I said, this was a really fun and interesting interview for me, and I hope you enjoy it. To hear Mary play, you might have to wait a minute for next season with the Metropolitan Opera Orchestra. But, if you enjoy the podcast, enjoy the interview, subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher. And I think I'm going to, I'm going to look into getting it up on Google Play as well. Put it out on as many platforms as possible. And if you subscribe and if you listen regularly, leave a review on iTunes or Stitcher. A good review, preferably, not a terrible one. So anyway, on to the interview. Talk to you next week. Oh, and before the episode gets underway, there was a strange, I'm not sure exactly what happened, but there was a GarageBand issue where GarageBand chewed up some of the audio. Not all of it, strangely enough, but just Mary's side for about 9 minutes right at the end. I could have just cut it all out it would have been pretty easy to just cut it all out, but we got into some really good stuff down there at the end. My voice comes through very clear. Hers is a little bit more difficult to hear. I filled with it as best I could, but the last 9 minutes are not quite as good quality sound-wise as the initial hour and 10 minutes. But you know, but bear with that. Sometimes that just kind of happens when it comes to dealing with computers and such. I sound like I'm 80. Oh, dealing with a computer, things happen. Why is this virus on here? I didn't click on that email from the Nigerian prince. Anyway, that's a weird tangent to get into. Anyway, enjoy the episode. Yeah. Bye.
You've thought of questions to ask me, but is there like a way you want it to go, or something you want to focus on? Or?
Well, that's the idea. The thing is I don't really come up with a list of questions, because mm-hmm. I like it to be more of a conversation than an interview per se. Mm-hmm. That way, a lot of times things come up in the course of conversation that I wouldn't have even thought of. Mm-hmm. I did one with a younger freelance violist, and we were talking, and all of a sudden we started talking about performance injuries, and we, you know, he had had some really, really serious problems that had lasted a number of years, and we talked through this whole thing about, you know, how dealing with that and dealing with that emotionally and mm-hmm. as well as physically.
Right, that you wouldn't have ever thought.
Right, and it was funny because we finished recording, and I was packing up, and he was like, oh, I don't think I've ever like just sat down and talked through like anything about my injuries before.
That's interesting.
You know, because, and I, of course, I'm not going to sit down and be like, oh yeah, these performance injuries that you've never talked about, I know about that. You know, that kind of a thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, string players, it's just rife with people who have gone through a lot.
But this is fun for me because I haven't talked to like an orchestral string player, and I've talked to several violinists and violists, cellists who do a lot of, you know, do orchestras, but mm-hmm. also a lot of their own stuff, solo kind of experimental stuff. Mm-hmm. And like I mentioned, I kind of talk to people who are kind of trying new things to find avenue. Any, you know, I always see there's money out there, but it's, you have to kind of go find it now.
Yeah,
it's not just gonna be, you're not just gonna
get a gig.
You're not just going to get a gig generally.
Yeah.
You know, unless you're one of the 0.5% of people who graduate every year who sat and practiced your excerpts
for
8 hours a day for the 8 years you were in school.
Yeah.
Coming off, you just finished the season with the Met.
This week's the last week.
This week is the last week. Yep. What's the grand finale?
Elektra. Saturday night.
No, just a nice, easy way to finish out the season.
Oh, it's the best way. It's like, oh, you walk out of there exhilarated.
Yeah.
That's good.
Exhilarated because of the music, or exhilarated because you finished another hard season?
You know, this year I don't feel so exhilarated about the hard season, but exhilarated about the music.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's funny, As a brass player, people just assume that I'm super into Strauss and Mahler and Bruckner. It's never been my favorite. I'll play it. I'll work on it, and I'll play it if I need to. If someone's paying me to play, hiring me to play something Strauss related, I'm just like, okay, I'll work on it. But
but when you're sitting in the middle of it,
yeah,
that's something. You know, I remember first time I played Elektra, and then I went to see it one night I wasn't playing it, and I thought, oh damn, it's much more exciting when you're in the middle of it. But then I went this past Saturday. I had an opportunity to go because I wasn't playing, and it swept me away much more. I don't know if that's my age or the production,
mm-hmm.
or who was singing, but it was pretty phenomenal.
Mm-hmm. So do you, for a musician like yourself, you know, is the summer kind of like a free time to recoup, or do you have a lot of stuff lined up
to take care, places to go, people to music to play.
It used to be that the Met played Parks in June and sometimes went on tour, sometimes in August, sometimes in May. And that's not happening so much anymore. So, and it's an incredibly taxing job. As a string player, you at any one time, you got to have like 7 operas in your fingers. Mm-hmm. You're playing some, rehearsing some. It's not like you have a bunch of them off. You know, you have to basically play everything. You're allowed, if you request way in advance, to take one off as a string player, but basically you gotta learn them all. And it's hard. It's mm-hmm. really hard. My summers alternately are playing and not playing. Like last summer, I filled in for a string quartet who needed a violist, and I was really happy doing that. That was great.
It's a nice chance to get to scratch an itch that you might not have had the chance to scratch for a few months.
Right, exactly. I mean, when I went to school, it was all chamber music for me. That's what I wanted to do. I played string quartets. I did all this. I was taught by all these European refugees who, you know, were amazing chamber musicians, and that's what I wanted. And when I first got out of school, I was freelancing and I played a lot more chamber music. I went to Marlborough, I did all of that, and I have a flute, viola, and harp trio that I still play with. We've been together for almost 30 years. But after a while, I realized that if you're a chamber musician and you're making a living at it, you're away from home 2/3 of the year.
Mm-hmm.
So I began to question that. And I freelanced a lot in the city. Then I really wanted to get a gig because I auditioned mm-hmm. for it, not because of who I knew.
Yeah.
You know, and so I started taking auditions. And
well, let's just, you know, back up all the way and like kind of start from the beginning. And we'll work our way through that kind of that kind of way. So where are you from originally?
I grew up in southern Pennsylvania, really in the country,
mm-hmm.
near Gettysburg. And so I was lucky. I had a really nice viola teacher. I started on viola.
Started on viola?
Yeah. I come from a family of 5 girls.
Uh-huh.
And my mother had us all play something, mm-hmm. and nobody played viola. We all ended up playing stringed instruments, sister violin, a sister cello, 1 piano. But nobody played viola or bass fiddle. So I wanted to be different. So I figured a bass fiddle was too big to carry around, and I chose viola. I was lucky enough to have a really good local teacher for
Were your parents musicians, or
no.
just kind of important for the, you know?
Yeah, you know, my parents, my father was a professor, my mother was a teacher, and my mother grew up in the Depression, and I think she would have loved to be a musician. She would have loved to be a piano player.
Mm.
But there was no financial opportunity for that to happen. So she made sure her daughters got that opportunity. And
yeah.
I'm the only one who's crazy enough to do it for a living. But that's how it started.
And you all play together?
No.
No?
No.
Never?
No. We would sing together and sing in car rides and everything. But no, we never played together, not even piano and a stringed instrument. I think it's because my mom was not really a stage mom. She just wanted us all to play something. She wasn't gonna, you know, oh, come here, play for the company. Let's, you know, and so we all were independent.
Mm-hmm.
So,
I mean, if you just said that you're the only one crazy enough to try and do it professionally, why did you even try in the first place? I mean, if you're coming from a group of people or from a background where there's, you know, it's more of a learn music to better yourself as a person type
mm-hmm.
of thing, why, you know, what drove you in that direction?
You know, I think a lot of us musicians were that way from birth.
Mm.
I mean, I was just so, I loved it and I wanted it. And as I got older, I realized, you know, as I started late. I didn't start viola until I was 10, which is kind of late for a stringed instrument.
Mm.
So I saw that I was kind of Well, no, I didn't immediately see that. I went to a summer camp. I went to Tanglewood High School program, and I saw that I was behind these people, you know, that I was, and I lit a fire under my butt. I just was, I knew that it's what I wanted, and I worked really hard.
Well, that makes sense.
Yeah.
the working hard part, yeah. Sounds about right.
Yeah.
So when did you well, you mentioned before we started recording that you kind of bounced around a bunch, you know, finishing school at different places.
Yeah.
And why so much moving around?
I think because I didn't come from an urban area. I didn't come from Manus Prep or Juilliard Prep. I came from the country. I was not an urban kid. I didn't know how people made a living doing music. I didn't know how people learn music. I didn't know who the good teachers were. I didn't have those connections.
Mm-hmm.
I remember I auditioned at Juilliard, and I was warming up in the former cello teacher's studio, Harvey Shapiro. And Harvey walked in and he was like, "Oh, you sound so good. You should have no trouble getting in." And I was like, "Wow, okay." And of course, I didn't get in.
Right.
I didn't know any of the viola teachers there. I didn't know anybody. Of course, I didn't get in. And so that started kind of, okay, what do I do next? How do I do this? So I went to study with Walter Trampler at Boston University. And I felt like he was an amazing teacher, but he didn't teach you any technique at all. He played for me, and I learned from what he did, but I needed some technique.
Mm-hmm.
So then I went to study with Karen Tuttle, and I just followed Karen Tuttle. Wherever she told me to go, I went. You know. So, and after getting my master's with Karen at Manus, I started freelancing and playing chamber music and Orpheus and St. Luke's and a lot of stuff with a guy, Sasha Schneider,
mm-hmm.
who is no longer around, but he, again, a lot of these European immigrants, I kind of took it for granted that this was the way the music world was. You had all these guys from Europe who were amazing teaching you. And I didn't realize I was in the sweet spot of string pedagogy.
Mm-hmm.
That these guys all came here because of the war, and they stayed afterwards. And then they all passed away.
Yeah, it's... So, I mean, if you think about it, like, in the context of, historically, like you said, they came over here because of the war. And even if you're over, if you're thinking pre-migration, if you will, a lot of these cities were still torn apart from World War I. And, you know, there's not that many, there are a lot of orchestras because it's Europe, and it's all this music is basically their music, if you think about it.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, you read a lot about these guys putting together their groups and being these incredible musicians and going around Europe, and then they all had to leave and created this, you know, had this huge, I don't want to call it a cult, but this huge following of people, not huge, I guess, I'm going to just like stumble around here, but this following of people in the States who, you know, were gleaning this chamber music culture from them, you know, that was very, very, very different than anything that had happened in, you know, anything that was around in the States. It's really fascinating to think about, you know, and maybe that wouldn't have happened, you know, that these kind of things where people wouldn't have had the opportunities to work with them if there hadn't been this huge war.
Yeah.
It's
my music education would have been really different.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if I would have had the wherewithal to go to Europe and study or not, but I didn't have to.
Mm-hmm.
These guys were here. And they all brought with them, I think, what is, it's subtle, but it's definitely not around anymore. Music was just important. What
mm-hmm.
they were doing was just important. Period. There was no question in their mind. There was no question that they were doing something that was worthwhile. They was not connected to money.
Mm-hmm.
They all came here, and I remember stories of them sitting around playing poker and waiting for the phone to ring.
Mm.
You know, and they're in their undershirts, smoking, trying to just, you know, and the phone, because of the way things were back then, you know, there was NBC, there was an incredible bunch of orchestras in New York, and there was a lot of recording. It worked out for them. But there was never any question in their minds that this was worthwhile. And I feel like nowadays, because we are so focused on things being valuable because they're worth something, or because you can turn them into a business, or because they would be a good investment and you'd get a return from it, I think that that has plagued the arts since the early 80s. And it's a bummer.
Yeah. The whole, you know, capitalist craze of the, you know, 80s, and it, there, you, if you look back, there is like a, there is a marked shift in the way that music functioned, as you know, economically, you know, whether that's because, you know, people stopped putting the emotional and the artistic value on it or whatever. I mean, that's, that may or may not be the case, but everything became so much more focused on money, especially in New York. I mean, this is the epicenter of all of it, is this whole making money. And I don't know, and it's, and it, I don't know if because I have only lived in this era, you know, I don't know whether it's gotten better or whether it's gotten worse, but it's, you know, it's just hard. it's hard to balance the idea of looking at it as an investment that you can get a return on,
right?
Because, you know, we all still, like a person like me, I, you know, I have to pay my rent.
Absolutely. You know?
But at the same time, it's really easy to lose focus on the fact that, yeah, this is overall, it's something that has to come from an artistic, emotional place, not just from a practical place. I've recently been thinking a lot more about that, just because I realize it's just, in our current culture, it's just crazy that anybody wants me to play trombone ever. I like the fact that I can play for money anywhere is kind of weird to me. I think about it, I'm like, how are there this many people that want trombonists to play for anything?
God bless New York City.
Like, exactly. Yeah. I probably wouldn't, there are very few places I'd be able to do what I'm doing, because there's just not, the fact that there's this many, you know, up and coming, like smaller opera companies or just orchestras that come through, or regional productions of whatever. It's just weird. And I use that to temper my, when I get in a bad place and start complaining too much.
Right.
You know, but so you finished up your schooling, and how long were you basically, you know, a freelancing violist in the city?
10 years.
10 years.
Yeah.
That's...
give or take. I think it might have been, you know, if you count that I was gigging before I left school, but basically 10 years. And then I really decided that I wanted to take auditions and get a job.
It was just a buildup of 10 years of, you know, just like having to kind of slog through things, or, you know, what changed that made you want to just be like, I'm done with this. I want the stability and the.
Yeah. I think anybody gets to a point in their life where they start, wanting things to be a little less of a crapshoot. So, There was that. There was, and I appreciate freelancing. I, to this day, miss it, because the kind of variation you get in your musical life, that you are meeting so many different people, and a lot of them play at such a high level, and just the variety, it's thrilling, you know, and I do miss that. But I felt like I was frustrated by how little you were asked to really audition, and how little you were asked, or how little you were listened to as an individual player.
Yeah.
And so that, and my wanting just a more regular life, at that point, that spurred me on to take some auditions.
So, I mean, what are some of the highlights of what you were able to do in that 10-year period? I mean...
Well, I started a flute viola trio with two colleagues and named Oriole, and to date we have at least 7 recordings. We just put another one in the can and we're waiting for it to be edited, and we were shortlisted for a Grammy. We were going on tour then, and when I got the Met job, we continued to go on tour. I loved playing with Sasha Schneider. I loved playing with Orpheus. I really loved all the smaller orchestras I got to play with. The chamber music opportunities were really fun. Yeah, so I got, you know, and also playing with, you know, Luther Vandross and all that kind of stuff. That's all fun too.
Mm-hmm.
And then I took how many auditions did I take? LA Chamber, New York Phil, St. Paul Chamber, and then the Met, and I won the Met.
And what year was that?
That was probably maybe before you were born. It was 1991.
No, I was alive. Yeah. I was alive. I made it into the 80s just by a little bit.
Yeah. I just knocked that, so I don't know. Since it's, yeah.
Cool.
Yeah, so since 91, I got it, and I started it. I got it in December, and because I was freelancing, I just started one month. I started in January.
Well, happy 25 years.
Yeah.
As a member of the Met.
Yeah. And the first 7 years, and I think I'm not alone in this, the first 7 years I felt like, oh, what? I can't possibly do this. I have no idea what's going on. It's so hard at first. It's so hard. I remember my first season, my stand partner who got the job with me, or shortly after I did, that first season we did Rosencavalier, The Ring, and Meistersinger, amid, you know, Turandot and Bohems and all the other
regulars.
Stuff. So, as a string player, Go to Damrong is 90 pages long.
Yeah, and it's a little heavy on the hands.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, and it's just like, you look at this stuff. I remember the first time I played Tristan, and we were doing the Venusberg music, and I thought, okay, everybody must fake through this part. And then I sat beside someone in the section, and I realized, no.
They basically have to memorize at this point.
Well, not, you know, it's too much. The bulk of it is too much
right.
to memorize. But she was playing it.
Yeah.
I thought, oh, shit. You know.
Well, it's funny. And I mean, I'm not saying it's like this across the board, but, you know, I play with a lot of string players in a number of different groups. And let's just say the preparation, with how heavy people's schedules are, the preparation can suffer, you know, and people will show up and have brushed over things, or, you know, kind of just maybe looked at it a little bit, or, you know, there's generally not a lot of people won't just like sit down and be like and shed something
right.
until it's perfect. It'll basically, it's sometimes it can be a kind of a game of good enough.
Right, of course.
Good enough for performance.
Yeah.
In string sections, just because, especially with something really difficult, you know, that's a lot of work. If you know,
yeah,
it's just a lot of time, and if you're not getting paid that much, well, then like what, you know, you have to balance the amount of time you spend for something that's not paying very much versus the amount of time that you can use from that to go work other places.
Right. And how much you're exposed in that particular piece. I mean,
right.
That's the same at the opera. There's, it just takes the years of doing it to get
mm-hmm.
it under your belt. And, you know, we're playing Elektra. So this is my third time playing Elektra. There's 3 separate viola parts. I've learned the third part and now I'm playing the second part. So,
mm-hmm.
And they're very different, the parts. And, you know, every time you play it, you walk away with a little more on your fingers. And
yeah.
That's just the way it is.
Well, and the expectations are different, too.
Yeah. Well, and I remember when we walked out, me and my stand partner, the first year of the job, we walked out having just rehearsed Meistersinger.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I felt like my hard drive was full. I just could not fit anything else in my head. And we walked out of the building, and we both just burst into tears and were like, what are we adding to this orchestra with our presence? I'm so overwhelmed. I feel like I cannot keep up with this. I'm just... But you realize that, okay, a lot of people had just come out of the recording of the mm-hmm. ring. So that's hours and hours where they had
that's all they were doing.
Yeah, right. And they just did the same thing over and over. It's a learning experience to record mm-hmm. something like that. It's a learning experience to record anything. And they had that with the ring. And I didn't take that into account in my, rookie mind.
Well, it's in any situation where you're playing with people who you consider to be that, the cool thing about being a freelancer is a lot of times I get the chance to play with people that if I were an orchestral guy, I would never get the chance to play alongside of principals of different orchestras unless I'm in their orchestra. Right.
Right.
But you get the chance to play alongside like some of the top freelance guys, on a fairly regular basis. I play with a lot of these guys most weeks, guys who have done every, all the shows imaginable or played in orchestras in Europe or whatever. And there's a tendency to like play with these guys who are technically now your peers, but you feel like you still feel like they're way up here and you're way down here, kind of a deal. And, in a lot of cases, that might be true.
Well, it has to do with experience.
Right. So, I just thinking about what you're saying, as a rookie member of the Met Orchestra, and it takes a while to kind of feel like I belong in this community.
Mm-hmm.
And
I had never played any opera. I mean, I played, what did I play? Out in Bensonhurst, I played, when I was freelancing, a Traviata that all the neighborhood got together and they raised the money, and once a year they would have this Traviata some opera, maybe not Traviata, in their high school auditorium.
Mm-hmm.
And it was violin, viola, cello, piano, flute, trumpet. That's it. And, so I played a Traviata that was like that, and I played one oddball opera at Curtis, and that was it.
Yeah.
I went to two operas beforehand, and I walked out of both of them, Boris Godunov, but it was also, to be fair, was in the day before the titles.
Yeah.
And I went to a city opera, Carmen, which I thought was okay. It just didn't get me.
Yeah. I have a hard time sitting through opera. I always enjoy playing operas,
mm-hmm.
even if the production isn't great, whatever, it doesn't matter. I like playing them.
Yeah.
But I have a hard time sitting through any, I don't know, even with the titles, it can get to me.
I think opera is something that, first of all, for me, just doing it mm-hmm. day in and day out added to my knowledge of it and my experience of it. And I think what really adds is just as you get older,
mm-hmm.
the whole thing, the having experienced some of those gigantic things that they're talking about,
right?
Love, death, betrayal, family. I think that your depth of experience has to do a lot with your connection. Not necessarily, but your connection to opera. I think
I never really thought about that.
They always talk about we have to get people under 40 to go to opera. You know what? I think it's the exceptional person who enjoys opera when they're under 40.
Yeah.
I think it's something that as you get older, it starts to resonate in a way that's really different.
Mm-hmm. I mean, what experience is a 20-year-old really going to have with, heartbreak on a massive scale? I mean, that might be,
it might be fascinating for them, it's not going
to
resonate
yeah.
the same way as it does after you've lost a family member,
mm-hmm.
which is the inevitable things that happen as you age. It's just a theory I have, but I really see with the people I know that that's true.
Interesting. Yeah, that's
I mean, it's
that's
still
an interesting thing to consider. I never even. But also, I've never. This is going to be a really. This is me being real. I haven't been to the Met.
Oh,
I haven't been there to see one of like the massive productions.
And you got to also on any given night, it can vary. Like the, you know, there's a lot of things at play. There is the
student
cast
tickets. When I was a student, the student tickets are still pretty expensive. And
yeah. And it wasn't your thing. I never went to the Met. I went to the Met with my sister to see Boris Godunov, and I walked out. I was like, oh God. Now, I love Boris.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but. And I remember going to see Manon Lescaut with amazing cast, Pavarotti and Franey.
Mm.
I mean, and just kind of waiting for the arias. And then, okay, then it's boring again, kind of thing. You know? I get if opera is not your cup of tea, I totally get it. And it definitely wasn't mine when I started.
Mm.
Definitely not.
When you started playing with
at the Met
group?
Oh, yeah. How would I have... That's, when do you get to play opera like that?
Yeah.
When?
But pretty much never. I mean, even now with, you know, it's been well documented. The Times has done a number of articles about it, and in different, you know, these smaller companies.
Oh yeah, Loft and.
Yeah, Loft and well, there's a, I just, why do I?
I was sorry to see that Gotham went.
Right.
Under. That was a really good
I there's this group I just did one, I did a Carmen with, and I can't remember the name, and it actually, like...
out in Brooklyn, right?
Well, it was in Brooklyn. It was supposed to be in Brooklyn, but we ended up playing at the Diamond Horseshoe, like, on 45th Street, like, right across from Hamilton.
Uh-huh.
And it was, like, the only production that I have done that actually paid commensurate to the time involved.
Uh-huh.
And I still can't. I keep.
Did you like
it? The name. Oh yeah. I mean, I play opera as much as I can. I enjoy playing it, and I've always enjoyed playing it. The first one I did my first production in when I was 16. I played a production of Traviata. I loved it. Like it's great. I love, you know, but I love specific ones. I'm big into Verdi and Puccini. I really like. I like listening to them.
Yeah.
I like playing them.
Does it have anything to do with liking it, having played it? Because so you like it because you just have played it.
I like Verdi and Puccini in abstract as well.
Uh-huh.
Generally, you know, I think part of it has to do with the lighter tones and you know,
and the tune,
the lighter tone. Of the operas, many times, even the more serious ones are a little bit lighter.
Mm-hmm.
Wagner gets so heavy, and
he's so full of himself.
Yeah, that's what I was gonna say. Self-indulgent.
Yeah,
I think
absolutely.
Just, Wagner and Strauss have so much going on that I never feel great just like sitting and listening to them. I like my orchestral music and my opera to be very orderly.
Uh-huh.
I mean, and even like. Puccini is most grandiose. It's still pretty orderly in the way he constructs things.
Yeah.
But these are all just personal opinions. I have no issues with anyone.
Uh-huh, right.
But you know, I really enjoyed it. But anyway, the point I was making is with these younger, these smaller opera companies popping up all over the place, younger musicians get more opportunities to play.
Right.
And you know, they're, you know, chances are none of us are going to play in the Met probably, but you know, they're.
Well, in the rate, like I saw the Loft opera's Rape of Lucretia.
Yeah.
And that piece never even gets done because it's on a small scale, and it was really interesting. And I think what they're doing is really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't replace the Met, but it definitely complements it.
They do things in a way that the Met can't do for reason. I mean, you know, when people go to the Met, they expect a grand scale, and even if it's like a more minimalistic production, a reimagination of a classic, you know, they expect like these really, really crazy artistic statements on the stage.
Right. Right.
Whereas a place like Loft, it's a very kind of like a, I don't know, like a punk rock opera, if you will. Like
there's definitely the grunge part of it, you know, and the beard intermission and
the the $20 across the board ticket price.
Yeah, but you know what? If I could be a millionaire, that's what I would do. I would subsidize classical music performances. I would subsidize, you know, people getting tickets to the opera. I would subsidize people getting tickets to the ballet and dance performances. I feel like that, I mean, that takes, you got to go again and again in order to begin to appreciate it.
And like, people can't afford to do that.
I know. Especially not with TV, HBO at home, you know, and you can stream anything, and
you know, that's $15 a month,
right? Exactly,
not $115 for one night,
right? Which, you know, is why it's great in Europe that they support their arts with state funding, but we don't have that here,
and that's just the way it is.
Yeah, and that's the way it is.
It usually ends up that there's like usually one or two productions a year that I really want to go to, like a few years ago with the Nico Muli opera. I really wanted to see that, but
bet you
just,
were busy the next.
It was busy and it was just too expensive and I couldn't do it. And,
yeah.
But that's, you know, that's the way it is sometimes. I'll maybe next time.
Yeah.
excuse me. Just as a, you know, we've kind of talked about how your appreciation for the art form has developed over the over your time with the orchestra, but and I guess, but from a like season to season perspective, you know, there's just how many operas is that every season, like 40 to 50? Is that right?
No, it's not that many. It's less than that. Ugh, how many?
I always see the list and I don't like go and count each one, but it seems like it's like 40. But
No, it's fewer than that, but it's a lot.
It's a lot. Yeah. And that varies from your Mozarts and your
Janáceks to your Nico Muli.
Let's be honest. I mean, Mozart's viola parts, not very interesting. I mean, they're kind of similar.
The opera is really...
The operas are great.
The opera,
but I'm talking about, like, specifically...
Uh-huh.
You know, Mozart, you know, it's just like... Boop, 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 in some of the string parts.
Uh-huh.
But then there's, like you said, Janáček is a lot more complicated and just, like, straight up taxing, I guess.
No, the Mozarts are really taxing, actually.
How so?
Physically. You just don't put your instrument down.
Mm.
The second violin part in Marriage of Figaro is really hard.
Mm-hmm.
It's just... Yeah, the quantity of notes and... Yeah, they're difficult. And plus, like opera always is, it's not exactly what's written on the page. If you're playing a Mozart symphony, it's exactly what's on the page.
Yeah.
It's not quite. And you kind of have to learn that.
And depends on who's singing the roles and who's conducting this time.
Yeah, and it's... With opera, it's kind of endlessly different and interesting. I can't say that I'm bored with Mozart viola parts.
That's good.
Yeah. I wish that there was, like, this year we did a lot of Donizetti.
Mm-hmm.
We did, you know, a lot. And we don't, I wish there was, I could use a Sibelius symphony, you know, but then we do have these concerts in Carnegie there. So I can't say that musically it's tedious. I can't. For me, that's just not true.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe someone different would have a different feeling, but I don't feel like that.
Well, that's when I talked to Ray about the similar kind of like season to season deal. He brought up the point that he liked it specifically because, as far as a stable classical music job goes, it's as close to like a freelance type deal as you can get, because you're bouncing in and out. You know, well, for a brass player, mm-hmm. You might not be needed until the third act of a specific opera, but you're doing several different operas every week, and you know, it's not, you know, all the same thing one week and then all the same thing the next week and
yeah.
repeat. I mean, there is repetition over
I mean, it's so difficult that it keeps it interesting.
Yeah.
Bottom line, for me, that's the way it goes.
If you know, you're playing all constantly, you know, throughout all the weeks, how do you keep yourself from getting injured then? I mean, that's a lot of...
That's hard. As a string player, that's a lot of...
How do you balance, like, you know, the maintenance type of practicing you have to do?
Yeah.
And if you're dealing with a Wagner or a Strauss, something that's more difficult, more exposed, maybe, you know, balance working those up for, you know, a month or so from now,
mm-hmm.
Against when we still have to do three different operas this week. You know?
Yeah. I'm always feel like I'm a little behind the eight ball that way. But, yeah, physically, I have to be very, very vigilant.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I stay in really good physical shape. I do a lot of, you know, exercise classes and Pilates, weightlifting, that kind of stuff. I ride my bike. That doesn't really... That's just a way of kind of arriving at work all fresh and with my blood flowing in my veins. But I do... I have a very good friend who's an Alexander Technique teacher, and she lives in Europe, but she deals specifically with string-related injuries and how to prevent them and how to change the setup on your instrument so it is more conducive to your body. So I have her as kind of a coach in the background when I need it. And Karen Tuttle was a very somatically integrated teacher. She was really aware of her body and how she used it when she was playing, and even how you can use it expressively in subtle ways while you're playing. So I had all that, and I think from her, and then I have, you know, my own physical, I just stay in shape. If I don't stay in physical shape, then things start to fall apart and ache and, you know, rotator cuff and the whole nine yards.
Well, the, you know, as a brass player, unless I'm playing for some weird reason, playing like wind band music, there is zero times, or like a heavy brass quintet deal, but there's never going to be a time when I have a horn on my face for an entire piece
of
music.
Yeah, but you can't, right? I mean, if the horn's on your face for the entire piece, your chops are just shot.
Well, it, you know, depends on how long the piece is, but...
Yeah, I see.
But also, if I'm doing bass trombone, you know, I have like little attachments to transfer the weight up here as opposed to just in my hand. But, you know, it can get tiring. But, corrected me, Mozart operas are very difficult because you don't put the instrument down.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I can't even, I have a hard time even, like, conceiving of that, because even, you know, shorter Mozart operas are still long.
Mm-hmm.
That's right. Still like at least 2.5 hours.
Yes. More, yeah.
Yeah, or more, right.
It's that short.
Yeah, so you're looking at 3 hours of at least of playing.
And Meistersinger, you never put the instrument down.
Right.
I mean, that's like, it's almost harder because you just don't have any rests. You're mm-hmm. always just plugging away in C major. So.
Well, then, you know, we just mentioned like kind of a larger scale way of keeping yourself going, but like just within the context of one piece,
mm-hmm.
like I have like literally no idea how that works. I like, you know, do you pace yourself?
You know,
working, making sure you're not using too much on your bow arm, like or you know, just the, you know, the strength within your shoulder. Like,
yeah, it's very that's a different lot. Than playing in a string quartet, which you give all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And when I first got the job, I, you know, that's what everybody does.
Right.
And you realize by the end of an hour, you're done. Or like, certainly by the end of 2.5 hours, you're done.
Mm-hmm.
But then you have at least another hour to go. So you learn to, it's not that you're, you know, you're playing less. You just learn to rein it in physically mm-hmm. and mentally and emotionally, you keep it a little closer to yourself. And I think that's just what you have to do. And I play in a string quartet members of the Met, and we get together, have three rehearsals, and then we play at someone's house or in a space, and we have a party afterwards for the audience. And there's always this, we always comment like, oh, wow, this is so different that way. How much energy you put forth right away, and how much energy you conserve when you're playing opera.
I'm a big fan of the Shostakovich string quartets, and a number of those, it's just, to use emoji speak, it's just like flames.
Mm-hmm.
Flames. Right. For, I don't know, 25 minutes?
Yeah, yeah.
And
you know, when you play Elektra, actually, Elektra is only an hour and a half, the opera, but, and you do play, that's a flame, that's it, like a, it's like a one long scream.
Yeah.
And you just space out for 30 seconds and you've fallen off the train.
But yeah, that's... yeah, it's easy in a freelance community to kind of I have days when I'm like running around all day, you know, where I have three rehearsals and then performance,
which
or
is
something,
exhausting,
which I love
in its own way.
When,
I mean,
like body wise, but yeah. Like playing wise, you know, when you're if I'm doing like all bass tremolo in one day, you know, it's a bigger mouthpiece. You don't play, you know, you're not playing constantly. You get used to kind of feeling okay at the end of the
right.
day, even
yeah.
if you've been playing a lot. But I had a situation, I don't know, a couple weeks ago where I did like 2.5 hours of big band rehearsal in the morning, and then I had something in the afternoon and I had to go right in and play Bruckner 9. And at the end of the symphony, like that's an hour long symphony, and the trombones play a lot comparatively.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And at the end I was like, Why am I tired? This is weird. I'm not used to having to pace myself on a piece of music, even something that's heavier. It's a thing that I kind of not used to doing anymore, is
yeah.
pacing myself. I can, especially like in a big band, and the big band, this group I was playing with, we're doing like these really nice arrangements of these like rock 60s, 70s rock stuff, and I can just like blow through it, like, really heavy. But then I had to go and do something. I was like, oh, I didn't pace myself. Great, way to be.
yeah. So by the end of the day, you're blah 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 blah.
Yeah,
blah.
Kind of. It had been a long time since I'd done that. Had that issue on bass tremolo.
Yeah.
Tenor.
Well, that's like a constant
story.
Thing in the opera. Constant.
Yeah. That's exactly that. Like, I guess that's kind of what I was the idea was I was shooting for there. So as every year in the orchestra, you have like just a number of different. A number of different conductors who come in. There's a lot. Obviously, it's been a little bit more consistent with Maestro Levine's health issues over the past however many years.
Yeah, 15 years.
You know, he's had a number of health issues that have kept him off the podium. So when different conductors come in to work with the orchestra, for whatever, you know, whatever it might be, how do you, you know, is it like a really huge, you know, obviously each conductor is very personal and does things differently, but how does that affect how like the string section might respond for a performance? Like, I'm not used to, you know, I'm used to like playing with a lot of different conductors, but not with the same people. You know, I'm not in a position, like I play with different conductors every week, but I'm also playing with a different group.
Right.
And, you know, when you're in a situation like where you've been playing with the same people for, you know, over a decade or more, you know, but then someone comes in who is not, you know, obviously there's returning guys who come back over and over again, but like how does the mentality or the style of the group kind of shift based on who's in front waving the stick?
Right, that's a good question, and it depends on the stature of the conductor, and I mean the musical stature.
Yeah.
I don't mean like how well known he is, although usually if they're well known, they are really good.
Usually.
You know, when you get an orchestra gig, you sacrifice, as a string player anyway, and I think that it's also, it's true across the board, you sacrifice your individuality as a player to basically a benevolent despot. And that's the conductor, because there is no way in an orchestra of 100 people, especially in opera, when you've got the stage and the orchestra and the production, all of this to tie together, right? There's just no way you could do it without that.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, I played with Orpheus, and I know, and I played a lot of chamber music, so I know what it's like not to play in a group that doesn't have a conductor. I understand that, and I enjoy that. I think it opens up your ears and opens up your playing in a lot of ways. But it's a sacrifice you make, as I am speaking for myself, that I made as an orchestra musician. And if the guy in front of you is not as good as you are, it's a huge disappointment. I mean, that's just, I'm putting it really bluntly. Mm-hmm. Back in the day when Jimmy was not ill, when the orchestra, it was like him conducting. I still remember his Don Giovanni, his Elektra, his Otello, the pacing, fantastic. And the orchestra, it was like old shoes. I remember when I first got the job, just sitting there and listening to an orchestra who, like, playing Meistersinger overture. And I thought, holy, they know the rest of the piece. Mm-hmm. It was like sitting in a Rolls Royce. It was, or Leonor III in the middle of Fidelio. It's like, oh my God, they know how it's connected to the rest. I mean, it's not just this overture that's just played and then
right.
You go on with the rest of the program. And there are certain conductors, there have been thrilling experiences for me at the Met. I remember when Thielmann came. I didn't know what I was doing. It was the first time I'd ever played Rosenkavalier, but it was, I remember Gatti doing Parsifal. Wow. Yeah. Simon Rattle doing Pelléas. Amazing. So there are moments when I feel like the orchestra is really transformed by the conductor in front of us.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also, you know, day in and day out. There's seven shows a week at the Met. So there's also, I find, I'll be really honest, like it takes an enormously good conductor to wake us up while we play Boheme, because it's something we all know. We could play it without the music. You need to, and people are tired. You really just physically tired.
Mm-hmm. It's a long season.
Yeah, and so there are certain operas, if you're not being asked to do something really different, you go into the groove.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess that's inevitable, but oh man, I'd like to see more great conductors. I really, the times that I remember Urolsky's Frauenschatten, fantastic, really amazing. You know, so I feel like as a string player, I might be just personally more invested in that, mm-hmm. invested in seeing somebody really great in front of me. It disappoints me a lot when that doesn't happen enough.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, I can't speak to that personally. But I can just imagine, you know.
And our orchestra, you know, the Met Orchestra has such potential,
mm-hmm.
and we play together so much, and it's a really group of great musicians. So, it's thrilling when that potential gets used,
mm-hmm.
really used.
Well, I mean, you just said that the you know when you. That it was like sitting in a Rolls Royce, but also you can drive the Rolls Royce 5 miles below the speed limit, you know, in a residential part of the city.
Yeah, I guess that's true.
You know, it's not always going.
Yeah, it's not always going to be the apex.
The reality
of music
is, you're
making.
Not going to be taking it. You know, you're not going to be busting through Montana at 120 miles an hour.
Yeah, well, and there is also having freelance, there's that thing of like when you freelance, you're doing something different all the time. There's not this feeling of you don't really know the full potential of any one orchestra you're playing in, because you play the gig, you play that week of concerts, and then you don't do it again for a while.
Yeah.
And or if you do it again, it might be with a subtly different group of people.
Or just a completely different group of people.
Yeah, right. And so it's and you get the variety.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's wonderful about freelancing.
But sometimes you, like, it's true with the pickup orchestras. You have the, with really good freelance orchestras, there is an element of, like, wild musical experimental musical potential. Like, mm-hmm. It can really go in a really, really great direction musically, but from a perspective of just ensemble cohesion, you know, and that can be really, it might not have the potential in that direction just because it's, you know, you have a week.
Right,
you
exactly, have a week, yeah.
Of people coming in from doing a lot of different stuff.
Right.
But the trade-off is that potential for, you know, an insane musical experience.
Right.
Because all these people do so many different things and have a lot of different ideas. It is a group of individuals coming together and playing an orchestra that might, you know, the concertmaster might have just, you know, might be coming off playing with whatever, like, Broadway or commercial, whatever, you mm-hmm. know, and he might take it in a completely different direction that you wouldn't have gotten if it was an orchestra that had played together a lot.
Right.
But the trade-off is that's giving up the individuality to become like a really, really cohesive unit. You know, it's just a potential in a different direction.
Yeah.
You know what I
mean? Yeah, absolutely.
So, I mean, obviously the orchestra does do a number of orchestral concerts every year. Is that kind of a respite? You know, I don't know how many is it every year itself. I feel like it's three or four.
I think it's usually three. I should know this, but yeah, I think it's three.
Well, I mean, I would assume that it just kind of all blends together after a while.
Yeah, so it's usually three or four in Carnegie, yeah.
You know, is that kind of a nice little respite from,
absolutely. For me, I remember when I first got the job is when they were just beginning to do these orchestra concerts. And, you know, I was so used to sitting on stage and playing orchestra concerts. It wasn't a big deal. And I felt like the whole band was kind of like, oh man, everybody can see us. Oh man, oh man. And I remember the principal violist, he dropped his music and they went all, I mean, it was just like, they just weren't used to playing on stage. And there was that added a kind of excitement to it that mm-hmm. was interesting.
So with, I mean, you know, I never, a lot of, when I was a student at Manus, obviously I studied with Dave Taylor, but the rest of the trombone teachers at Manus all play in the Met.
Oh.
And I was the only one, you know, generally there's one person at any one time who studies with Dave as opposed to the Met guys.
Oh, but I see. Uh-huh.
For most of the time when I was at Manus, it was me.
Yeah.
But everyone else, they kind of like, you know, they get a feel for, oh, this is what the pit is like, or this is what, you know, this is what, you know, I have no idea. So, cause I never did my lessons on the stage,
right,
like some of the guys did, or in the locker room, whatever. Mm-hmm. I was always playing weird,
mm-hmm.
playing weird music that I arranged myself in an apartment
yeah.
on the Upper West Side for my teacher.
Right.
So it's kind of just like the, you know, the pit life, like, you know, there, I mean, it's different. My experiences playing in pits are usually like nowhere near enough room. The audience can still see you, so you get yelled at if you like are reading a book. And
yeah, that's absolutely right. Both counts.
But you know, like I said, I have never even been to the Met, so I don't even know like what it even. I just see pictures.
Yeah.
Because I don't, you know, I don't go.
Yeah, we gotta get you there, boy.
Yeah. Well, you know, but you know, we just like you know, a regular, is it. Do you have like enough room down there to, you know, it's
No, never
enough room.
There's you figure it out. But it's definitely, you know, you figure it out. It's like there's, depending on where you're sitting in the viola section, it can really impact how much you can move, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's hard not to get an attitude because the French horns take up so much room and they basically don't have to move when they play. They just put the thing up to their lips and they blow. And I'm like trying to move and I don't have enough room with my bow arm and my viola. And so, yeah, that can be difficult. And you know what? It's kind of like living in Japan. You know, you're all on this little island. You're really stuffed on there. You have to be polite and it has to work. So you can't like be too much like of a diva and want your own space or your own thing. You got to compromise. So in a way, I think that adds to the rapport because if you don't get along, it's really nasty
really uncomfortable.
Because you're sitting 5 inches away from the next person. And you also are much more aware of, like usually I'm sitting beside the French horns and the English horns. So in a symphony orchestra, these guys are like, you don't even see them.
Yeah.
You can potentially play an entire concert and just hear them and leave. And
right.
No, I'm like almost sitting in their lap. So it makes for interesting rapport and I think a deeper rapport.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's hard. And also there's this, when I first got the job and I still feel it, like you're sitting there in the dark, it's kind of hard to see your music, it's hard to get situated, you're not necessarily following the conductor,
right.
You're not necessarily following the singers, you have to be like, your ears just have to be wide open so that you can just, somebody makes a mistake, you can go with it, and it's a very, it's just such a different feeling than sitting on a stage, sitting on a stage, period. Whether you're playing a string quartet or you're playing in an orchestra, it's really a different experience. And I treasure my experiences during the year of going out on the road with my trio and really walking out on stage and playing, like having to dress in something colorful and having that rapport with the audience.
Yeah.
Because it's a very kind of, there's so many things that you have to pay attention to when you're playing opera. It's not just the two other people you're playing with. It's so much.
So I just have a few more things I was kind of curious about, but then we can kind of wrap it up. But you know, so you've been in the orchestra for 25 years, and obviously there's a lot of, but there's changes that happen within your section and within other sections, you know, just personnel changes, you know, from year to year or decade to decade, depending on how long people stick around.
Right.
one thing I've always wondered about, particularly because, you know, playing in a string section is so vastly different than playing, you know, trombone section. Each of us has our own part.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just, you know, and even though you mentioned like Elektra has three different viola parts,
mm-hmm.
it's three very different viola parts. It's, you know, you're still playing a section a lot of times. From what I've seen, you know, the most difference you have is sometimes there's Debussy.
Mm-hmm.
But when someone new comes into the section, I'm assuming the viola section isn't exactly the same as it was in 1991.
Yeah. it's not.
Okay, good. Because some brass players stick around for 50 years. You never know.
Yeah.
How does that, how do you, not deal, but when someone new comes into the section, like, how does that affect, I'm assuming depending on the production also, you know, dictates the number of violas you have.
Not that much though.
Okay,
yeah.
So how many are there?
There's usually four stands.
So yeah, okay. I would have guessed
sometimes five.
I would have guessed eight, so that would have been pretty close.
Yeah.
So like, how does, you know, when one person, when a new person or a new face or a new couple people come in,
mm-hmm.
how does that affect, and how do you kind of, you know, bring them along into what you do?
Yeah, that's very different for each person in the section, how they bring them along, I think.
Well, I mean, of course, you know, different people are going to handle it differently.
Yeah.
But what do you kind of do? You know, how does it work for you if there's someone new? Or you just ice them out? It's, you know.
No, because you feel, I think I'm pretty much, I'm not alone in this. You feel compassion for them because you've been through it. So you're like, you know that this is going to take a while. you hope that you can communicate to them what they might not know or what they might not do. And you hope that they're that kind of person that can listen to that, and also that you can say it the right way. There's definitely a learning curve, but the learning curve is really steep at the Met. So I think we're all pretty compassionate about it.
Mm.
And it usually people are surprised how much they like it. And I think people have varying experiences with how much opera they've played, but mostly people haven't played very much. So again, you feel compassion and you want to help them. And it's a hard thing to fit into. I guess mostly I try to show them by my playing and my behavior what's expected, and people catch on really quickly. So
well, and also, I mean, you don't want to, if you're a new person, you don't want to lose the job, because that's always a possibility.
Yeah, right. So, yeah. Exactly.
I mean, like, the you're not going to come in and be like, generally, I would assume, you're not going to come in and be some sort of like snotty hotshot, because you can't.
Well, yeah, there's always people who try, but yeah. But I think basically people are very, very kind.
I don't get how anyone would think that they could do that, because that's just me. Because that just, I mean, coming into something where you're around people who've been doing it so much longer than you and know so much more than you, but that's just me personally. Like, why would you even try to pull that? Because anyway, that's I'm just kind of like blown away that anyone would do that. But then, you know, there's always people who will, I guess.
Or they just don't quite understand the breadth of knowledge they're missing.
Yeah.
You know, there's that in anything, not just in music. But
that's, yeah, I guess that's true.
But I think what strikes me about opera is how emotionally it gets under your skin.
Hmm.
I mean, there are nights where people cry in the orchestra.
Really?
Oh,
I thought they were all just emotionless robots.
No.
That's me being a snarky freelancer.
No, because it just really gets under your skin. I can say that it really, without exception, gets under your skin.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, did Ray talk about that when you interviewed him?
No.
Because he's a trumpet player.
He's a trumpet player, yeah. Well, it took him a while to get into the opera, because he was a guy who always, the dude knows so much, he's so good on orchestral music, and that's, you know, that was his, I mean, he made the finals of 17 auditions,
mm-hmm,
before he won the Met, you know, like that's, and that was, orchestral thing was, you know, it just took him a while to get into the opera mode. Kind of a deal, but
yeah, it's a very different mode, yeah, for sure.
And especially as a trumpet player,
I know we played Pictures with Jersey, and I heard that it sounded fantastic.
I'm sure.
Yeah,
I always liked when he would, because Manus doesn't have a bass trombonist right now, so they hired me to come in and do a lot of their stuff,
mm-hmm,
on bass and tenor. But you know, I always liked it when he would pull out the horn and like tell the student to like get up, and he would play in the brass section, because it just always sounds so good. anyway, but back to the idea that, you know, it just really gets under your skin still, mm-hmm, to this day. You know, is that just the pure music? Is that like a combination of the music and the director, or just, you know?
No, that's the music and the singing.
Music and the singing.
That's, doesn't really have to do with the production, because that's not where my...
Oh, I guess when I said the production, I meant the...
Oh, the conductor.
Yeah.
Yeah, it does have to do with that, too.
I mean, how much are you...
But it's not necessarily... I think having... It absolutely formed me as a player to hear the human voice night after night after night. And, like, the best. The best opera singers in the world, you know? And I didn't realize it. And then, you know, maybe 10, 15 years into the job, I was playing a chamber music concert. And I realized, oh my God, it's totally affected how I play. It's totally affected what I expect from a piece of music. It's totally affected what I expect from what's around me, playing wise. And I think it's added to my playing. It's added so much to my playing. I had no idea that that would happen.
Mm-hmm.
Because everybody talks about that. Oh, you know, what we're all trying to do is imitate the human voice. That's what, you know, music is all about. You know, well, if you've never been exposed to it so much, you don't know what the hell they're talking about.
I guess, are there specific works that, like, always get you, like, that always kind of push you into a different headspace musically?
Yeah, there are moments.
I see.
Definitely.
Which, like, are there...
Well, okay, electro, for sure. Mm-hmm. That's happening now with the Met. Don Carlo, the King Philip's... the late at night aria where he's like talking right before the Grand Inquisitor comes in. Oh, gets me every time. And Yanufa, there are moments in Janáček's opera, Yanufa, that totally rip my heart out. There's Tosca, second act when she kills Scarpia is always exciting to me. There's like a moment in Bohème during one of the arias in the first act. Always, I wait. Sometimes we play it better than other nights. You know, some nights we'll play it better than other nights, but if it's a good night, it can just be magic. The trio at the end of Rosenkavalier, you know, there's
I mean, you could go through, you know, pretty much, probably most, you know, a lot of the things that you play every year and pick out spots.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's really cool. I mean, when you're on the outside, a lot of times you just kind of hear stories about people who just have been in whatever orchestra, whether it's New York, Boston, wherever, it doesn't matter, who just have been in the orchestra for forever and just kind of hate their lives for whatever reason.
Yeah.
I
was really afraid that would happen to me when I finally won a job after auditioning. I was really scared that would happen, that I'd let go of everything else musically in my life and somehow buy into that cynicism. But, you know, one reason I haven't is the Met job is just so hard. It's hard for me. It doesn't really get that much easier. And I think that's helpful.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, you work to keep yourself engaged, I would imagine. And...
Yeah, I don't think... I think that that's one of the reasons freelancers don't get cynical, is the difficulty. I think that there is... I mean, I don't want to trumpet that too much, because it's hard enough to be a musician. But I think that a breadth of experience is really important.
Mm.
And... feeling humility is really important.
Well,
I mean, sincerely feeling humility about what you do is really important. And I guess I never feel like I've just totally got it. I never feel, although there are surely nights where it's boring. I never consistently feel bored. I feel more frustrated than cynical about problems within the organization. As a musician, damn, it's hard to do what we do, man. We've all put so much time and energy into it. It's a shame when you sink down into that cynical place, you know, where you get frustrated because things aren't what you want them to be. I mean, I'm wondering, like, why does that happen? And to some orchestral players, why does the bitterness set in? I think part of it is boredom. Part of it's lack of control of your destiny, you know? I don't know. What do you think?
I would imagine it varies from person to person.
Yeah.
But,
it has a lot of personality.
Yeah. If I don't know, there are some... I don't know. You know, I'm not personally acquainted with any of the string teachers who have taught the people I knew at Manus, but you hear things about teachers telling their students that playing an orchestra is basically not what you want to do. Like it's basically like that's a subpar career playing in an orchestra.
Yeah, and I was definitely told that.
You know, and
that was implied a lot.
Or if you feel that you should be in a better orchestra or be in a better position within your own orchestra, or you hate the conductor for whatever reason, or I don't know. In the place that I'm in, I'm just happy if I can work. But if I do something that's like something that's really good, that's better, pays better, whatever. If I do something the next week that's maybe not as good, doesn't pay as well, I'm just kind of, I'm kind of like, I should be doing more of the better paying stuff and less of the worse paying.
And there is, being a classical musician, there's an element about that, that you are always striving. You know, you're always trying to be at the top of your game, and when the circumstances are preventing you from doing that, that's really frustrating.
And I just personally, I just try to act like strive for whatever is better, not be happy, because the striving for something better, it's easy to just settle in a specific gig bracket. You're making enough money to pay your rent, it's really easy to settle there and not strive for something that's better within.
Yeah, and
I
feel like that's also absolutely true at the Met too, and especially because it's such a taxing job that it's really hard to do stuff outside. It's almost punishing when you do stuff outside the Met as a string player.
And from a purely financial point of view, like the paycheck is good, even though New York's expensive. Like you are commensurated well for being a member of the orchestra.
Yeah.
Like, so there, it can, I would imagine, again, don't have the experience with it, but I would imagine that it's challenging when you, like you say, it's really taxing to try and do something outside of that.
Mm-hmm.
It could be easy to sit and just work on what's on your stand every week.
Yeah.
Because that's hard enough.
Right.
But.
And also you get to a point, I think I'm at a point where I'm looking for, I'm looking to broaden my musical horizons.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so if you always, and that's not easy, because, when you get a job like the Met or the Philharmonic or BSO, you're separated out from music in it's not even the mainstream. You're just separated out. You've got your gig.
Yeah.
That, and you lose touch with the other stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And so, last year I started teaching kids at this Opus 118. There's this East Shore alum, this wonderful woman, Roberta, started a violin program, and it's so comprehensive. She's got it so well organized. She has great teachers working with her. You know that it was years ago, but Meryl Streep was in this Music from the Heart movie.
Mm-hmm.
It's about her.
Right.
And so I started teaching there, and I've never taught little kids before. I've always taught, people who are going to be musicians.
Right.
It's just really interesting. It's so cool because these kids are so wide open, and it's such a comprehensive program that you don't feel frustrated that you're just like teaching them the violin, and then it's just they're not going to go home and practice, and they're not really going to get anything out of it except for that half an hour a week that you're there. It's really comprehensive, and so I feel like I'm adding to the lovers of classical music in the long run.
Mm-hmm.
the people that are fascinated with stringed instruments, you know, in the short run. And that's been really interesting. So I think you just got to keep pushing yourself, keep pushing that envelope in whatever direction. I do.
Yeah. Well, I think we got it.
Good.
Not today. But anyway, thank you so much for sitting down with me.
Sure.
Appreciate it.
It was fun.